Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle, a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. In the first part of Mercury Mysteries, The Scientist's Tale, we introduced some of the leading scientists who have been involved in mercury research in the United States and let them describe in their own words the challenges involved in trying to address the threat of mercury contamination. These men, Anders Andreyen, David Krabbenhoft, Jim Hurley, and Chris Babiarz, shared their experience of the foundational phases of mercury research from the 1960s through the 1980s. These initial efforts to understand the actions of trace metals in ecosystems led to the realization of the need to adopt clean techniques in order to accurately monitor levels of mercury in the environment. Bioaccumulation of methylmercury was also introduced. This is a crucial concept in comprehending how the mercury cycle affects human beings, and we will begin part two of Mercury Mysteries, The Scientist's Tale, with Chris Babiarz explaining why.
It's really the form of mercury that's most important for what affects your health. There's a particular form of mercury called methylmercury that sticks to the muscle tissue in animals, and that's the one that affects the nervous system. When I tell people I'm working on mercury, they think, of course, of the metallic form that's in the thermometers, and usually tell me about how they like to play with that, you know, years ago when those was more common. But as it turns out, that particular form of mercury is fairly inert as far as the work that I'm doing. It doesn't react so much. That is the form that kicks up into the atmosphere, though, and will stay there. In the atmospheric processes, it can be converted into an ionic form where it has a charge to it, and that's why it likes to stick to particles, and then it gets rained out. It's that part that has a charge to it that if it can find some type of counter ion, a chloride or something, get itself neutral and get itself off of large particles, it can float across the cell membrane of a bacteria, and then the bacteria wants to get it out of there. So it throws a methyl group on it and voila, methylmercury. And then that's the form that gets taken up in the food chain.
There are many forms of mercury, but the most insidious form is called methylmercury. And methylmercury is formed from inorganic mercury by bacteria in the environment. We have mobilized a lot of mercury, mainly through fossil fuel burning. Vapor mercury gets into the atmosphere and is then transported on a global basis all over the place. Then that falls down, and some of that will be methylated. And we have increased the amount of methylated mercury in the environment by mobilizing so much mercury.
Almost all of the mercury in fish is the methyl form of mercury. So our little mass balance with a half a gram, that might not have been the amount of mercury that was in the fish. The amount that was in the fish might have been a small portion of that, and it would have been in the methyl form. So now we're starting to bring more and more environmental scientists in from many, many different disciplines to try to understand the mercury cycle.
One of the themes that I hope I leave on mercury research here in Wisconsin, but also nationally in the U.S., if not internationally, is a recognition of how important the non-mercury factors are towards understanding why some lakes exhibit very high levels of mercury in fish and others don't at all. And as it turns out, hydrologic factors and geologic factors are at least as important as the mercury direct loading amount in determining how much mercury gets in fish. And a good example of that that I can illustrate for you is to note that early on in our research in northern Wisconsin, we would sample lakes that would all be clustering, say, within about 5 or 10 square miles of each other. And yet, the same fish species at the same age would show 100 or 500 times variability from lake to lake, just in the amount of mercury from a single kind of fish. So we quickly realized that in a situation like that, where all the lakes are receiving the same amount of mercury falling down from the sky per square area, that there's something else important that's going on. And as it turns out, those discoveries were made in kind of the second phase of our mercury research, where we learn that there's a very key process called mercury methylation, which changes the form of the mercury from inorganic mercury, or HG as we call it, to methylated mercury, and that's simply a mercury atom with a methyl group, which is CH3. And when that happens, the mercury becomes far more toxic to biological systems because it accumulates in animals and fish to a much higher degree once it's become methylated. And that rate at which it changes from inorganic mercury to methyl mercury varies tremendously between different lakes and streams. And the key features that control that difference are how the landscape and the hydrology of the watershed varies from lake to lake. So some lakes that have very low communication with their groundwater systems will have low pH water and tend to have a lot of wetlands around them. And those are the systems that it turns out are very efficient at converting the inorganic mercury to methyl mercury and generally show high levels of mercury in fish. On the other hand, if your lake has a significant exchange with the groundwater system, it will tend to have a much higher pH and a lower amount of wetlands and features like that around the shoreline. And as a result, you'll generally see much lower levels of mercury in the food web. And so even though two lakes that might have those two different basic settings have exactly the same amount of mercury coming into them, the amount that actually gets methylated and ends up in the fish can be extremely different just because of their landscape position. And that complete understanding of what controls this larger problem of high levels of mercury in fish needs to be posed against our basic understanding of ecology and hydrology and geology so that a complete understanding can then be related to decision makers in state capitals and our nation's capital.
I think that over the last 10 to 15 years, work on contaminants in the environment has taken on a much more sophisticated aspect in the sense that in the late 60s and early 70s, we spent all of our time trying mainly to measure concentrations of contaminants in the environment, not really knowing the risk of these things, but just developing analytical techniques and finding out how much is there in the environment, where do these compounds come from, and how long do they stay, and where do they go. Actually, we found out in the 80s that a lot of our measurements had been erroneous. We hadn't taken the necessary precautions to sample things correctly and to store things correctly in clean glassware and Teflon and all these sort of things. Then in the early 90s, there was a little bit of a renaissance in going back and remeasuring concentrations in the environment. After that, we really started applying chemistry to understand exactly the source of materials, the modes of transportation, i.e., some compounds are apt to travel through the air more easily, some through water, and some are more apt to get into groundwater, some in surface water, and so forth. So we really started to apply chemistry. And in addition to that, I branched into organic compounds. The chemistry got even more interesting in that these compounds undergo a variety of additional type of modifications in the environment.
The amount of time that it took us to understand and sort out why lakes directly adjacent to each other would exhibit such dramatically different concentrations of mercury in similar fish species and age took about 2 or 3 years to start pointing us in the right direction. At first, it was a very difficult problem to resolve. We stewed and pondered, and we could see the data segregating into different lake types, but we really didn't understand the relative importance of this process called methylation. We knew mercury could get methylated. That was in the literature. We knew that there were natural processes that potentially could methylate mercury. And we knew that mercury in fish was largely of the methylmercury form. What we didn't understand is whether or not the mercury got methylated after the fish consumed the mercury. We didn't understand what controlled methylation. We didn't understand why certain types of lakes would necessarily be more or less prone to methylate the mercury. And so in what I would call the second phase of our research, which moved us from looking for the mercury source back in the 80s. In the early 90s, the whole field moved towards understanding what controlled mercury methylation and why it varied from different ecosystem type to other kinds of ecosystems on the landscape.
We started to work together with the toxicologists to do risk assessments. What does it really mean to the general population and to individuals? Now they knew the exact doses and concentrations that you encountered in the environment, so they could make much more realistic experiments as to doses that humans and different animals would deal with. In the last 5 years, things have really gotten fascinating because of the application of biotechnological techniques, understanding toxicology at a molecular level. In the next 10 years or so, we might even be able to start making risk assessments on certain compounds that are person-specific. I have now moved from the laboratory in the last 10 years to a position where I have an overview of where the different fields are going, and toxicology is really moving. We are getting a fundamental understanding of the genome, of all of the genes that are involved in responding to environmental insults.
In 2006, we were asked to host the 8th International Conference on Mercury as a Global Pollutant. We brought about 1,100 people from around the world to Madison to discuss their research, their education, their outreach, all of these types of mercury work. The conference was the International Conference on Mercury as a Global Pollutant. For me, it was probably one of the most significant mercury events in my life, being a big part of that. Typically, when you go to scientific conferences, you go to a conference and you'll hear some plenary speakers. You'll then go into different breakout sessions where everybody gives their research results in a manner where they stand up in the front of the room and lecture to you, a number of different lectures all capped into one. We wanted to do something a little different with the Mercury Conference here. We wanted to not only make it more of a conversation, but also make some products out of that that are more than just a technical publication in a prestigious mercury journal. So about a year before the conference, we brought experts from around the world in mercury research, in mercury cycling in the environment, in the socioeconomics of mercury, all different aspects. We broke them up into four different teams and we asked them to focus on some specific questions. We charged each of these four different groups to come up with a panel that would present their answers to those questions to the entire assembly, have a conversation from that, and then take the key points out of their discussions and put together a declaration. We ended up coming up with what we called the Madison Mercury Declaration. These are the truths that we believe are self-evident, that type of thing. All the scientists came together and endorsed this document of what they thought the current state of the science was. We didn't want to go into it saying, we think that the policy should be cap and trade because so-and-so. We didn't get into the policy implications, but we thought that what would be of most value would be to come up with a declaration that was scientific-based that someone could then use to make policy decisions. And we're all really pleased with the way that it came out. There were some politics involved in it, too. We had groups that didn't want to see any regulation of mercury in coal-fired plants, and they had the ability to say something. They had an ability to vote on the declaration, and the declaration went through. It passed overwhelmingly. It was up in the 90-plus percent. But it also gave everyone that came to that conference, it gave them all a feeling that they were part of it. The declaration did not have a lead author on it. It was the sense of the entire mercury community. In effect, we were doing similar types of things to other scientific conferences, like the Montreal conference that ended up really understanding chlorofluorocarbons. They came out with a declaration. We felt that telling people what we all believe is the state of the science and doing that type of outreach was such an important part of this conference. The 10th conference will be held next year in Nova Scotia. We hope that future conferences will revisit it and maybe give us an update on the current science of mercury.
I think the single most important thing that we do with our data is to be able to understand how mercury moves through a system, how it converts from one place to another. That information is very useful if you want to control how that pollution travels in the environment. What's nice is in this particular field, there's a global community of scientists studying this because it's a global problem, right? It's an atmospheric problem. You know, mercury gets in the air, will travel around the globe for a year or two and land somewhere else. I have a network of associates around the world that I get to see every 2 to 3 years at a mercury conference. And it's at those conferences, often held in places affected by direct mercury pollution problems. We had a conference in Minamata, Japan, the year before it was in China, where they're having issues with all the coal and industrialization there. So when you go to those conferences, it becomes crystal clear why we do this work and why it's so important. And that helps motivate you to get back into the field and deal with all the problems and issues that make you pull your hair out.
Mercury work right now has moved all over the world. And there is a lot of work going on that we are involved with, but only peripherally. One of the great mysteries right now that a lot of people are working on is how oceanic fish accumulate so much mercury, and where does the methylation take place in the vast ocean? Is it the same mechanism that we see in freshwater lakes? Most of the mercury in the ocean has been hypothesized to be formed in the coastal regions, but that hypothesis is falling down a little bit right now because there's just too much methylmercury around. There's got to be some other methods. They're probably methylated in the water column in biologically rich regions of the world's oceans. And so a lot of work is going in that area. We're not directly involved in that, but we laid the foundation to a lot of that work which is going on.
I've had the ability to meet scientists from all over the world who are attacking similar types of problems in their countries. Probably one of the deepest effects that I've had seeing mercury use face-to-face was that I had a trip about 4 years ago to Brazil. We were asked as part of a United Nations commission to come down and talk to artisanal gold miners, small-scale gold miners. And we went up to a camp in the town of Yobelina in Brazil.
Even today, one of the biggest outputs of mercury into the environment is from small-scale artisanal gold mining in the Amazon. The amount of mercury that goes out into the air there is enormous.
We went up into the mountains outside of Yobelina. There were piles and piles of waste material from a mineral mine on the side of this hill. And down from that, there was a small hidden camp of small-scale gold miners in this camp, basically illegally. They weren't allowed by law to be in there. But what they were doing was taking the waste mineral, crushing it, running it across a sluice. And in the sluice, there were these beads of mercury. What they were doing was concentrating gold. When I thought about it, I thought, my goodness, I mean, this is the same technique that the California gold miners were using more than 100 years ago. The health effects back then were the health effects now. And it seemed like we've made all of these other technological advances, but this basic gold/mercury amalgamation technique, which worked back in the California gold mines, was still being used. And it was still exposing the artisanal miners to just huge amounts of mercury. They would take the amalgam of gold and mercury, bring it inside a tent, and burn it inside the tent because they didn't want anybody to see that they were actually using mercury and getting the gold that way. When we went in there, we actually brought a handheld mercury detector with us, which really isn't that sensitive at all. They were inhaling concentrations that were thousands of times higher than you would get outside of St. Louis, say, an industrial area. What we were trying to do with the miners project was teach them some new methods for both improving their health and reusing their mercury, so that they didn't blow off the mercury into a tent where they were all doing this type of technique, but that they could actually improve their health just by doing something as simple as putting a glass jar over the top of that. What's interesting is that there were other environmental groups that said that what we were doing was so wrong because we were encouraging them to still use mercury. Those are the types of moments that you think, where are we going with our rabid environmentalism? You know, the main thing there would be to protect their human health, not destroy their way of life. So let's add another discipline to multidisciplinary approaches to studying mercury, and that's the social science side of it, the socioeconomics. There's much more to it. Yes, it would be great that we don't have any mercury used at all in small-scale gold mining, that there were some other techniques that they could use. But here we were 150 years past the gold mining in California and in the West, and they were still using the same technique. So we can make steps a little bit smaller, but we also have to balance ways of life and the economics of the situation too. So it's a very complex study, mercury. If we talk about how to control emissions of mercury worldwide, how to reduce coal burning and mercury and the release of mercury from coal burning, we really have to think how that affects the rest of the world. It might be a little bit technologically easier to do here in the United States. It might be a heck of a lot more difficult to do in other parts of the world. And the gold mining / mercury use is a similar example of that. We don't do large-scale gold mining with mercury here in the United States anymore. We use some different techniques, but we haven't been able to transfer those techniques worldwide where people who are doing them feel that it's not only cost-effective, but it's health-effective too.
When it comes to mercury research in the past 40 years now, we have learned an incredible amount how mercury is produced, how mercury is used, how mercury is spread through the environment, and also, equally important, how to avoid mercury contamination and mercury uptake. It's amazing what we have learned, and a lot of, quote, green engineering has gone into making now products that are mercury-free. In the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s, and even 70s, it was an incredible amount of mercury that was used for a variety of different applications. We have improved a lot in our understanding, and we have some ways to go yet. Right now, for example, most of the mercury in the environment, which is being moved around and added, is via fossil fuel burning. Hopefully, one of these days, we will be able to say that we are curtailing that as well.
This podcast was produced by Chris Bocast, that's me, for the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. The scientists you heard were Anders Andreyan, David Krabenhoff, Jim Hurley, and Chris Babiars. This podcast is public domain. Thanks for listening.